Lal to lower the main hatch anyway. But I was frowning as I looked at Abram and said, "What supplies?" Bolts released. The hatch began squealing down slowly. "That," Abram said, nodding toward cargo amidships. "Look, I talked more to Lal. The watchman had sold every bloody thing he could get hold of. You'd have been eating your boots till you got to the next landfall, and those," he glanced down at my feet and grinned, "are plastic, right?"
"Synthetic, yeah," I said.
"But look, Abram, what did all this cost?"
"Not a bloody thing so far as you're concerned," he said.
"I meant that money for you," I said.
"Well, then I spent it on what I wanted, didn't I?" Abram said.
"Look, how much do you think my family eats? Or what do you think there is to buy in the hills?"
The hatch, now a ramp, clanged onto the outrigger. I squeezed Abram's shoulder and looked away from him.
"All right," I said.
"Platt, get aboard. Go into the cabin. Monica, go with him."
"You said you'd let me go," the consul said in a wobbly voice.
"You'll go back with a lighter," I said, "but I'm getting you out of my way for now."
Platt turned and began trudging up the ramp. Monica looked sharply at me before following. I gave her my pistol, but first, I was going to need both my hands for shifting the stores.
Chapter 25.
The boatmen, they may have been two brothers, both of about 40, helped us unload the lighter. When I made my first trip up the ramp carrying a case of dehydrated food, it had been manufactured on Plaisance, almost certainly from the stores of a ship captured by pirates. I got my first view of the interior of the Alfraz. I hadn't expected much, but it was worse than that. A replacement fusion bottle had been placed in the hold in a corner, with the bulkhead separating the cabin from the hold. It was a large unit, probably out of a major warship. A freighter's power room wouldn't have been able to hold it, so a dockyard had dispensed with the usual containment bulkheads and just put the bottle where it would fit. Heavy conduits ran from the bottle in several directions. One of them entered the cabin through a U-shaped cut in the pressure hatch from the hold. The hold had been packed with some gummy material which I hoped was airtight. In theory, the cargo hold should hold an atmosphere so long as the main hatch was closed, but there was always leakage on older ships. I was afraid that on the Alfraz there would be a lot of leakage. I set my load down and clamped it with one of the hold's internal tie-downs. Half of them were missing, but because they were part of the ship's fabric, the watchman hadn't sold them, the way he apparently had everything loose. I said to Abram, coming in with a similar load, "I'm going to check the console." I walked into the cabin. The bunks in two stacks, three and three, stood on either side of the communicating hatch. They were slotted metal sheets, four of them still folded against the bulkhead. Their padding was gone. A local man, presumably the watchman, lay on his back on one, snoring. Platt sat on the other lowered bunk, looking frightened and uncomfortable. Monica had rotated the console's seat so that she could keep the pistol aimed at Platt's belly. "I need to check the controls," I said. Monica got up, without speaking, and stood against the starboard bulkhead. Her eyes and the gun muzzle remained fixed on Platt. The console came up promptly. The holographic display had good definition, much better than that of the Martinique. Like the fusion bottle, it had been salvaged from a naval vessel. I checked the readouts. The bottle was running in the green, which was a blessing because I was pretty sure that Lal wasn't a competent tech. Neither was I, but I was probably up to the average of engineers in this region of the galaxy. The reaction mass tanks were very low. There was no excuse for that, since the ship floated in a bay which could have topped them off in a few hours. I didn't have time to take care of it now, but it would be my first priority on our next landing. I checked the astrogation data. There was full information with waypoints for a run back to Karst, but except for that, it was spotty. Planets had only cursory legends, air, water, or none at all. I hadn't expected much, but again, reality was at least as bad as I'd feared. I started the internal pumps to circulate reaction mass to the propulsion system, the plasma thrusters, and the antimatter converters which fed the high-drive motors. The system worked to 80% of original specifications, which was quite good. If the drive units were in comparable shape, we'd be all right. "We'll lift as soon as we finish loading," I explained to Monica as I left the cabin. She nodded but didn't speak. It took a full half hour for the five of us to empty the lighter. I didn't even consider asking Ahmed to help. Even if he hadn't been drunk, he was too frail to add much to the process. We got the job done, though. I went into the cabin to get Ahmed.
We're just about done, I said to Monica. I bent to pick up the watchman since he obviously wasn't up to leaving on his own. I suddenly had another thought. Platt, I said, where's your purse? They're going to rob me now? He snapped. Don't push your luck, I said. I lifted his tunic and opened the belt purse I found under it. It was heavy, but there were only 22 car sequins and about 100 piastres in local coins. I put the sequins in my own purse and transferred the piastres to Ahmed's. It was the only way he was going to collect any of his back pay. Up you go, buddy, I said to the watchman, lifting him with his right arm over my shoulders. I used my right hand to keep his face turned away from me in case he vomited. As we shuffled off the ship, I called over my shoulder. As soon as we've got him aboard, you can let Platt go too. Lal and Abram were in the hold. Both came to help me with the watchman, but Abram got to him first. The boatmen had gone back to their vessel. The stern was starting to swing away from the Alfraz's outrigger because they'd loosed the aft mooring line. Thanks, I said across the lolling drunk between us. I put some money in his purse. Can he shelter in a hut down here? I'll fix it, Abram said. He'll probably get robbed, but the sun'll probably rise in the east, too. We laid the watchman in the lighter with his head lifted slightly on the tarpaulin that had covered the stores. Abram, I said as I straightened, if you're ever in a place that I can help you, let me know. I've owed you from the first day I arrived on Ben Yusuf. He looked away. Yeah, well, he said, you treated me square. He looked up again and met my eyes. You trusted me, boss. Nobody ever trusted me before. Then they're fools, I said. I don't know what I might have said next, but the shots inside the ship stopped me. There were two, whack, whack. They were louder, but not as sharp as a pistol usually sounds. With the second shot, I heard the slug ricocheting off the steel bulkheads. Prepare to cast off, I shouted to Abram as I sprinted up the ramp. I didn't want Abram to be caught in this, whatever the hell had happened. Lal was at the internal hatchway, looking into the cabin. I brushed past him and ran inside. Monica stood holding the pistol. The heated barrel glowed slightly, and the vaporized aluminum driving bands shimmered above the weapon. Platt quivered face down on the deck. There was a splash of blood on the bulkhead behind where he'd been sitting. I didn't know where the first slug had gone until I rolled the body over. It had broken his shoulder but hadn't penetrated the bone. His eyes were open but glazing. I looked up at Monica. What happened? I said. She thrust the pistol at me muzzle first. Her face was wild. Take it, she said. Take it! I did, if only to get it out of Monica's hands. I grabbed it by the receiver, but I managed to touch the hot tip of the barrel to the inside of my wrist. I shouted and jerked away. I was lucky not to fling the weapon into the overhead. What happened, I repeated, as I took the pistol by the grip and put it on safe. I was working to sound calm, both for Monica's sake and my own. He smiled at me, she said. Her voice was clear, but I thought I must have misunderstood. What? When he thought he was going to be released, she said, swallowing. He smiled. Just the way he did before he raped me. I shot him. I didn't know I was going to shoot him. She swallowed again and said, and I shot him again. Well, no loss, I said, though my stomach was roiling. That was partly the smell. Platt's bowels had released when he died. I walked back into the hold and stood in the hatchway. The lighter still floated alongside, though Abram held the bow hawser in both hands. Everything's fine, I called. Platt's going off with us. Don't forget to let the driver go from the car trunk, all right? I returned to the cabin and set the main hatch closing. Over the squeal, I said, prepare for liftoff, both of you. Monica, we've got cushions and bedding in the hold. See if you can get that struck down while Lal and I are busy. The external sensors had terrible optics, but the lighter was big enough that I could follow its wake to the dark, sharpless blob of the vessel itself. It was far enough out that I figured it was safe to light our thrusters at low output. I wished there was somebody in the power room, but I suspect the Alfraz had operated without an engineer for her whole active life. Lighting 1 and 6, I said. The PA speaker in the cabin had so much distortion that I couldn't have understood the words myself. The one in the hold seemed a little clearer, though I couldn't be sure over the interference from the nearer unit. The thrusters lighted properly. Feed pressure didn't drop. I shut down the first pair and said, lighting 2 and 5. The second pair ran smoothly also. I hadn't been able to check them externally, but the instrument seemed happy. When I heard the hatch close, I turned and shouted to Lal, get the body into the hold. We'll dump him when we enter the matrix. I pointed and made arm gestures to show him what I wanted. Lal hesitated at the order, which I didn't blame him for. Worst case, I'd take care of Platt myself when we reached orbit, but I'd really have liked to get rid of the smell and also the lump in the corner of my eye. Monica got up from where she was attaching the cushions to the bunks. She grabbed Platt by the wrists and dragged him toward the hatch. When she got there, Lal came and lifted the body by the ankles until they had it over the combing. They dumped it in the hold and together pulled the connecting hatch too. I shut down 2 and 5, then called, "Lighting 3 and 4. As I ran up the middle pair of thrusters, I switched my shortwave transmitter to 20 meters and called, "Cars transport Al-Fraz to Salam Control. We are preparing for immediate liftoff." There was no response, as I'd expected. Lal was on the striker seat. Monica lay down on a bunk, not the one beneath the splash of the consul's blood on the bulkhead. That was probably the best choice for liftoff, though I doubted whether the Al-Fraz could accelerate hard enough to worry about. As my last act as a resident of Ben Yusuf, I opened a link to the palace console. I'd set it up 2 days ago, when I'd begun to firm up my plan for escape. Through it, I locked out the anti-ship batteries on the jaws of the harbor. They would continue to function normally, except that they wouldn't accept the launch signal. It would be easy to reverse my program edit as soon as somebody noticed it. I was pretty sure that would be long after the Al-Fraz had left the region of Ben Yusuf. It was likely enough that the crews would never realize that their batteries weren't functional. That was pretty much the norm for governmental departments in Salam. "Lighting all thrusters," I said. With all 6 venting plasma into the harbor, the Al-Fraz rocked and pitched. Mostly that was the water boiling under our outriggers, because with the nozzles flared, the thrusters provided very little impulse. "Lifting in 5 seconds, I said. I was shouting, but I doubt my companions could hear me. It was what they must have expected, though, even Monica. I ran the thrusters up to full output, checked briefly that there were no instrument anomalies, and said, "Lifting off!" I sphinctered the thruster leaves to minimum. We rose more slowly than I'd feared. The Al-Fraz was taking on a list to port, but that was alignment. Output on all 6 thrusters was within a 2% range, but either port or starboard was misaligned. They were all supposed to be set at 90 degrees. I adjusted the port set 5 degrees inward, choosing by guess. I was ready to reverse the controls if we started toward a roll, but in fact the hull shifted properly upright. The maneuver had been dangerous. We'd probably have reached orbit if I'd done nothing. But because the thruster output was marginal for our weight, I'd been sure that I'd have enough time to correct the mistake if I'd guessed wrong. We'd reached the upper levels of Ben Yusuf's atmosphere. "Switching to high drive," I said, and cut them in. The Al-Fraz had only 4 motors, so our acceleration until we inserted into the matrix would be painfully slight. But beggars can't be choosers. The high drive made a nasty buzz as matter and antimatter recombined. This was a much more efficient way to accelerate us, but it got on my nerves the way the steady roaring of the thrusters did not. I began calculating a course as the ship drove outward. There was no reason to pause in orbit. We all wanted to be away from Ben Yusuf, and straight out was as efficient a method as there was. Monica unstrapped herself from her bunk and walked over to the console. Our acceleration was below 1.5 GS, so it wasn't a remarkable feat. It must have been work, though. "We're off Ben Yusuf, aren't we?" she shouted in my ear. "Yeah," I said. 20 miles above the surface is the legal definition, and we're above all but traces of atmosphere." I looked at her. "We're a long way short of getting where we want to go, though," I said. "Where I wanted to go was off that horrible planet," Monica said. Then she kissed me. Monica went back to the bunk. It took me a while to get back to my course calculations, but eventually I did. I hadn't had time to check the suit locker. When I thought of it, I was momentarily dizzy with fear. If the watchman had been able to get into it, he would have sold the suits as he had everything else. My only choice then would have been to land at another harbor on Ben Yusuf and purchase at least 1 suit there, hoping that the news from Salam wouldn't arrive before I'd been able to do that. That was unlikely, since I'd have to earn money for the suit. I didn't have a clue as to how to do that. I grinned. Perhaps Lal and I could rob a pirate cutter. If it had been Abram with me, I might have thought I had a chance. The suit locker was secure storage opened by the console. That was common on freighters on the fringes. Weapons and liquor would be similarly secured, though the Al-Fraz carried neither. I opened the locker and stood. "Let's go take a look," I shouted to Lal, but Monica joined us as well. I breathed out in relief as I saw suits. I was glad to have anything, though the reality wasn't great. The only hard suit was missing the left lower leg. The four air suits had all their limbs, but I could see gaps at the joints of one when I manipulated them. I could have repaired that well enough for the purpose with a roll of cargo tape, the sturdy material designed to keep cargo from shifting in the hold under sideways acceleration. Unfortunately, any cargo tape aboard the Alfraz had been sold for Ahmed's upkeep. "Well, I figure two of them will work," I said to Lal, hoping that I sounded cheerful. "That's an advantage of being short-crewed, right?" "And perhaps the rigging won't need much help," Lal said, showing that he was trying to keep up spirits as well. Our sensors didn't show any other ship above Ben Yusuf. I didn't trust the Alfraz's electronics, but I hoped they were good enough to warn me at least if there were another ship closing with ours. "I'm going to raise the rig," I shouted to my companions over the discharge of the high drive. As soon as I thought we had time, I was going to swap the speaker in the hold for the useless one here in the cabin. I set the rig to deploy in standby condition, sails furled and yards remaining vertical against the antennas. The bolts and clamps withdrew like a badly performed version of the Anvil Chorus. Whines and squeals followed as hydraulic motors began to lift the antennas. "Captain," said Lal, "do you want me to go out and see how the equipment is working?" I shook my head and shouted, "No. Neither of us go out until we can go out together. I won't trust the suits until we've tried them. We'll each be ready to get the other back to the airlock if something goes wrong. If they both failed at the same time, we were screwed. So for that matter was Monica." I smiled reassuringly toward her. It was the only thing I could do. Her expression didn't change, but she nodded in acknowledgement. When the sound of the rig ceased, I took a deep breath and shut off the high drive. I said in a loud, clear voice, "We will enter the matrix in 5 seconds. Entering the matrix now." I pressed the execute button with the heel of my palm. The Alfraz entered the matrix as smoothly as a fish leaps back into the sea. In that aspect, at least, our ship was exceptionally good. I could only hope that she would extract as easily when the time came. I queued up the course data, then pressed execute again. Rising from the console, I said to Lal, "Let's get suits on and inspect the ship, shall we?" So far, so good. The air suits didn't fall apart when we pulled them on. Monica hovered close, but she didn't get in the way or ask questions. She was obviously nervous, but she kept it controlled. I set the pistol on the floor of the locker, just to get it out of my pocket. There wasn't room inside the suit anyway. It was possible we'd need it again. I had needed it to cow Platt and his driver, but I sure didn't like having it on me. There turned out to be tools in the locker, a kit attached to the belt of the hard suit and a separate kit with only an adjustable wrench and combination screwdriver pry bar. I suspect the tools with the hard suit had been forgotten when the leg was removed and the suit became unserviceable. The airlock was beside the console. We entered and I immediately locked down my helmet. I began turning and moving my limbs as pumps evacuated the lock. If something was going to let go, I'd rather that it happened while I was still aboard. Lal watched me impassively. I suppose he was used to equipment of this quality. The suit he'd been wearing when I grabbed him as he floated away from the Martinique was worse than the one he'd taken from the locker. We checked the magnets in the boot soles before we got into the airlock. When the pump stopped, I unlocked the outer hatch and led Lal onto the hull. The matrix surrounded us in pastel glory. Captain Leary had told me he was in the presence of God every time he stood in the matrix. I wasn't spiritual, but it was a magnificent thing, even to me. Our family had never been religious, though Mom had made a point of attending fashionable temples when money had lifted us into higher society. When I stood in the matrix, I could imagine that the God-bothering types might be right, but might be, that was all. With a single ring of antennas, it was easy to make a circuit of inspection. Proper safety lines had gone down the watchman's belly if there'd been any aboard. But I'd cut 2 50-foot lengths from the coil of rope Abram had provided. It was woven from the leaf spines of a desert tree and was good enough for the purpose. I'd have preferred RCN standard beryllium monocrystal, but something around my waist was better than something in a warehouse on Cinnabar. The ventral antenna hadn't rotated properly, though the yards were extended and had shaken the sails out. They were blocking Casimir radiation to drive us off course, unfortunately. I opened the cover of the gearbox at the base of the antenna. A tower gear spun determinedly, but it wasn't turning the cog which should have driven the antenna. I removed the hydraulic line. When the gears stopped, we could see that the lower half, The beveled side had been worn smooth. It was misaligned, so a portion of the teeth had been having to do the work of the whole length. Remembering Barnes's lesson, I unlocked the tower gear from its retaining clip, turned it upside down, and reclipped it. When I reconnected the hydraulic line, the antenna started rotating properly. I was grinning as I stood and gestured Lal back to the airlock. This had been a good watch. "Give me a moment," I said to Monica as we entered. "I'll tell you what's going on after I've reset this." I didn't bother taking off the air suit before I sat down at the console, though I had removed the helmet. I recomputed our course to correct for the time the antenna failed to turn. When I sent that command to the rig, I stood up, stretched, and walked over to the locker to change. Lal had removed his suit while I was busy. He wore shorts and a sleeveless tunic, and was barefoot as he'd been even on the ground. That wasn't uncommon in Salaam, though at least half the men had sandals. The boots that Captain Hakim had worn when he captured the Martinique were unique in my experience. He probably wore them as a mark of rank. "The rig is working now," I said as I stripped off the leggings. "We repaired a gear. It ought to be replaced, but it seems to be working now."
"The captain repaired the motor," Lal said to Monica. "I could not have."
"You can now," I said. "You hadn't been trained, is all. If we get to a civilized planet, maybe we can buy a replacement. I don't know what we'd use for money." I hung up the air suit. Thinking about it, I might be able to trade my skill at a computer for a used tower gear. Ben Yusuf might be unusually ignorant, but I suspect in this arm of the galaxy, my level of expertise would have been a boon to most chandleries or scrapyards. Even on Xenos, I'd have been more used to Petersburg in the office than I was as a flunky. "When we get to Saguntum," Monica said from where she sat, "I can get as much money as we need." "Well, for now, we're heading in the other direction," I said, sitting on the bottom bunk of the other stack. "We need reaction mass, and such navigational data as we have indicates there's a water world almost as close in the other direction as there would be if we'd headed for Saguntum. There may not be anybody chasing us from Ben Yusuf, but I really don't want to be recaptured."
"I'm in your hands," Monica said simply.
The bulkhead behind me was wet. While Lal and I were on the hull, Monica must have washed Platt's remains off the steel. I remembered that I'd meant to put the body out when we entered the Matrix. Well, so long as we got rid of it before we were next in contact with anybody. I let out my breath again, feeling more relaxed than I had since I'd been shanghaied aboard the Martinique. Aloud, I said, "We're on our way." Chapter 26. We extracted from the Matrix about the right distance from the unnamed planet's primary. We were on the wrong side of the primary, though, where the world we wanted would be in another half-circuit. I felt too awful to even pretend to be pleased with my astrogation. I'd had a reasonably easy time with extractions before now. Even veteran spacers talked about how bad they felt after an extraction, so I'd been congratulating myself for being one of the lucky ones. I'd been one of the lucky ones. This time I felt as though my flesh had been replaced with half-melted ice cubes, which then had been poured back inside my skin. I was shivering so badly that I had difficulty entering the new course data. "Inserting into the Matrix," I said, "now." I closed my eyes as I pressed execute this time, because I didn't want to think about what I was doing. Entering the Matrix meant that I'd have to extract again, and right at this moment I'd almost rather have died than do that. If other people feel this way, how do they manage to keep on doing it, I thought. We shuddered into the Matrix. It was a short hop, crossing the orbit. Probably less than 300 million miles. We could even have managed it using the high drive in the sidereal universe. I didn't feel quite miserable enough to start the calculations for that, because I knew it would be a matter of weeks or even months. But I was almost that miserable.
"I feel awful," Monica said. "Someone is chopping on my head with an axe."
Lal sat with his head in his hand, saying nothing. I guess it was all of us. Maybe it had just been an unusually bad extraction. A telltale on the display winked at me. "Extracting," I said, and threw the toggle. It was as gentle as sliding into warm cream. I muttered a prayer. I hadn't prayed before the extraction because I didn't in my heart of hearts believe in divine powers. I was willing to thank powers that might not be, though, rather than not be courteous in case they were real. We were above our destination at about 100,000 miles.
I made quick calculations and entered a high drive burn of just under 3 minutes to kick us into orbit so that we could pick a landing spot. Lal was on the striker's seat, but Monica came and stood beside me, gripping the back of my couch when we entered freefall. The world below was half deep ocean, but the other half was a shallow sea with thousands of islands. Mostly the islands were arrayed in strings and circles. Even where the land didn't break surface, I could see patterning on the bottom. There were no signs of human involvement, but many of the islands were green, especially around the fringes. The ship's optics weren't good enough for me to make out details. I guess it doesn't matter where I land, I said. We'll have water regardless.
Land in a lagoon, Monica said. We may not be able to go ashore, but we'll have some protection if there's a storm. And if we can go ashore, I'd like that.
We'll do that, I said. I located a spot on the surface, marked it on the display, and set the console to calculate the landing. Better take your bunk, I said to Monica. I'm using the automatic landing program, so I don't know when or how long we'll be breaking. The thrusters kicked in, starting us down toward the surface. It caught Monica by surprise, but her two-handed grip on my couch kept her from falling. She returned to her bunk with two quick strides, which were just short of leaps, then strapped herself in. I kept my hands on the controls, but though the descent was rough, I didn't even consider making a manual landing. I practiced constantly with the console, but lives depended now on the landing. I could probably have brought us in safely, but the console certainly could. I had a lot to learn and nothing at all to prove. I expected the banging in the lower atmosphere to become violently worse when a rigging clamp failed and some major assembly tore off, or possibly tore the ship apart instead. That didn't happen, and the buffeting reduced. The image on the display had degraded with the vibration, but it sharpened as our speed dropped. I saw that we were heading for the center of an atoll. This console didn't pause to hover as some programs did. Instead, we plunged toward the water swiftly until the pressure of steam and reflected thrust brought us into dynamic balance for a moment. The thruster shut off and dropped the Alfraz the remaining distance to the surface of the lagoon. It was probably no more than a few inches, but it was enough to shake me. Monica yelped, and Lal fell off the striker seat to sprawl on the deck. Next time I'd bring us down the last 10 feet myself. But we were safe, as best I could tell. I unhooked my restraint harness. All right, I said. We can't open the ship up yet, but we can start filling the reaction mass tanks. The pump was in the main hold. I opened the fairing and lowered the intake pipe, but the pump icon on the console display was yellowed out. It's not recognizing the pump, I said aloud, hoping that when I heard the words, an obvious answer would occur to me. It's been rewired when the new bottle was put in, Lal called from the hold. Would you like me to throw it? Wait, I said, because I wasn't about to agree to something that I didn't understand. I walked into the hold and saw Lal with his hand on a knife switch projecting from a control box beside the main hatch. A heavy lead entered from the fusion bottle. Another ran to the intake pump on the other side. Why is it like this? I said. Lal shrugged. They didn't want to reprogram the console, he said. So they left the control circuit in place, but put in a separate power switch. I've seen it before, or setups like it. I took in what Lal had said. All right, I said. He threw the switch in a sudden spurt of blue sparks. I walked back to the console. The pump icon was live again. I switched it on and was gratified by the heavy vibration as the pump began sucking the lagoon's contents into the tanks. When I first boarded the Alfraz, I'd noticed the octopus of armored conduits leading from the fusion bottle. They'd been clamped to the deck into bulkheads rather than being buried within the ship's fabric as the originals had been. I'd been disgusted, but in a detached fashion. I hadn't made a detailed study on the new routings. If I'd had a thought, it was to hope I'd soon return to civilized planets on which even tramp freighters had to meet higher standards if they were to lift off after inspection. I suppose I was better off to remain in ignorance as long as I could. I just added to my list of necessary repairs, once we'd reached a repair yard, to put a cage over the knife switch. It wouldn't be possible to rewire the pump without a full rebuild, but it wasn't necessary to leave high amperage connectors open to the air. Let's take a look at our new world, I said to Monica, speaking as cheerfully as I could. No reason to tell her that we were riding in a death trap. Want to name it? I started the hatch to open. Thank goodness it hadn't needed rewiring also. No, Monica said. I just want to get home. I really want to get home.
Don't we all, my dear? I said. But as the words came out, I wondered what my home was now. Xenos 3 years ago, I suppose. Simply going back to a cheap apartment on Cinnabar wouldn't take me home. When the hatch opened, the local atmosphere rushed in with the residues of our exhaust. I sneezed from the ozone, but the usual stench of garbage incinerated by our thruster exhaust was absent. I smiled. We weren't in a regular harbor into which ships and often the community itself dumped waste. This was a barren island without civilized amenities. We were in the middle of the lagoon. On the blue-green water around us floated the bodies of worms from 6 inches to a foot long, probably boiled by our exhaust. Winged creatures about 2 feet long made short hops from the low islands around us, hovered momentarily above the water, and stabbed down with long tongues. Most of them concentrated on the worms we killed, but other flyers were plucking similar worms from the lagoon's fringes, beyond the range the plasma had heated. I think they have exoskeletons, Monica said, walking out on the ramp. I wonder if we could catch one. Like insects, you mean? I said. I joined her, though I'd just as soon not get too close myself. The creature's long noses uncoiled at least 6 inches to spike the worms. Even if they weren't poisonous, I didn't want anything 6 inches long driven into my body. Well, like insects or lobsters, Monica said. But they must have real lungs to fly like that. The creatures had thin bodies with 4 slender limbs. The wings were translucent fabric, stretching between the pair of limbs on each side. I didn't know if the creatures could walk on the ground. They landed with their prey only momentarily, then spat off the worm's shrunken husk and hopped into the air again. They clicked as they flew. I wasn't sure where the sound came from, the wingtips touching at the bottom of each stroke, I suspected. But the air was alive with it. The pump started to labor. I wanted to believe that I was imagining the change in note, but walked back into the hold. It seemed to me that the water wasn't humping as actively as it had been along the side of our hull, above where the intake was. The pump began shaking angrily in its housing. I didn't take the time to check flow rate on the console. I lifted the knife switch and the pump shut off. "What's the matter with it?" Lal asked as I headed for the console. "I hope it's just sucked up some mud," I said, though that didn't seem likely. The water was so clear that I could see the sand bottom. According to the console display, the reaction mass tank had come up enough to notice, but was nowhere near full. I guess at the back of my mind, I'd hoped that the anti-backflow switch hadn't shut the pump off when the tank had filled. I went back to the pump itself and laid a hand on the housing. It was cool to the touch, so at least an internal problem hadn't burned it up. "Okay," I said to Lal. "We'll go down and see what's in the screen. First, though, we're going to disconnect the top end of the intake pipe." "Can I help?" said Monica, who'd come in with us. "I guess you can hand us tools," I said. "Going to be tight even for two in the housing, though." We got to work. The 8-inch pipe was dense plastic rather than the steel I'd expected, so at least we didn't have to worry about corrosion. Structural plastic was better in a non-stressed application like this, but it really couldn't be repaired, even on a world as benighted as Ben Yusuf. You could find somebody who could weld steel. We took the bottom flange loose first, handing the nuts and bolts to Monica as we removed them. "Why are you doing that?" she asked. "Can you reach the blockage that way?" "No," I said as I stood and stretched before we started work on the upper flange of the elbow. "This is just so that if the pump turns on while we're at the intake opening, we don't get sucked up the pipe." "But that can't happen, can it?" Monica said, frowning. "It can't if we take a 3-foot section out of the pipe," I said, handing her the next nut and then knocking the bolt clear to give her also. I couldn't imagine Monica throwing the big switch while we were down there, and I'd taken the pump offline at the console as well. Regardless, we had time to do this job safely. I didn't see any reason to take risks to save half an hour that we wouldn't miss. Lal and I put on air suits but left the helmets off. I had no idea what was in the water beside the worms. As I started toward the hold, I heard a splash. I ran through the connecting hatch a good deal faster than I'd planned. Monica was standing out on the ramp. It was only after I'd gotten to the main hatch that I saw what had made the splash. Platt's body floated in the lagoon. At least she tossed it over the end of the ramp. There it floated on the other side of the outrigger from where Lal and I would be working on the pipe. I didn't say anything, but Monica raised her jaw as she looked at me. She said, "It was about time we got rid of that. It was just covered with a tarp.
Time and past, I agreed, walking to the outrigger and out on it. I looped a line over a top cleat. Kept meaning to put him out every time we inserted, but I kept forgetting. I sat and dangled my legs in the water, wishing we had a proper ladder. Gripping the rope, I let my body down and paddled over to the intake. The magnetic soles kept my feet down, and the laden toolkit at my waist gave me almost perfect neutral buoyancy. I could have adjusted that by adding or removing tools, but I was glad not to have to. I found the underwater intake easily, because the open cover plate stood at 90 degrees from the hull. Even without a light, I could see that the grating looked fuzzy instead of a sharp-edged grid of heavy wire. It was moving, like a dog's fur in a breeze. "The worms are trying to get in," Lal said from the other side of the opening. "Why are they doing that, do you think?"
"They probably got sucked in," I said, thinking about it. "There must be a mother huge lot of them in this lagoon. Do you suppose they hatched here?"
Lal didn't answer, but it didn't matter. They were soft-bodied and shouldn't be a problem if their pureed flesh went into the reaction mass tanks. We'd have picked up worse in most harbors on developed worlds.
"Okay," I said. "We'll take the grate off, fill the tank, and then put the grate back on before we lift. Otherwise, it'll just jam again as soon as we start the pump."
"Yes, Captain," Lal said. He was a skilled and experienced spacer, but anything out of his experience was an impenetrable problem to him. He didn't even begin to think about it. His mind just switched off. That was better than getting a lot of back chat from a subordinate, I suppose. But I'd have been glad to get a second opinion on some of this business. It was all new to me, too. There were 12 bolts, threaded into the hull itself. I put them down the throats of our suits, rather than chancing trying to put them into the toolkit and maybe losing one. The grate didn't get a lot of stress when the cover plate was closed, but I didn't fully trust the cover plate either. I didn't trust any part of the structure of the Alfrost. When we got the grating off, I said to Lal, "Get back on the ramp and I'll hand this up to you. We'll get the pump running again, then clean this before we put it back on." Lal splashed over to the outrigger, where he could get onto the ship again. I worked my way along the side with care, using my magnetic boots to grip where there was nothing for my hands. The grating was in the crook of my right arm, and I held the safety line in my left hand. I couldn't swim with the weight of the grating, let alone swim with one hand. Keeping my head above water with my feet on the curving hull was like holding a sit-up midway. Lal reached the midpoint on the ramp when I did. By lying on his belly and reaching down, he managed to take the grating, which allowed me to relax and let my legs drop. Inside the ship, Monica screamed, then shouted, "Help! Help me!" Lal dropped the grating with a clang and ran into the hold. I tried to lift myself directly onto the ramp, which was stupid. I could have done it in shorts and a jersey, but not with a suit and the weight of the toolkit. Using the rope and all the strength of my arms, I hauled myself to the outrigger and climbed out. Monica called something, but her voice was distorted. I heard the sounds as, "I can't hold it!" I ran up the ramp. I couldn't see Monica, but Lal was using a wrench as a club to pound the yellow-white form that hunched up at the internal hatch. It was a worm like the thousands of worms in the lagoon, but this was the size of a cow. The cabin hatch burst open. Monica hadn't gotten to it in time to dog it shut. She shouted a despairing curse. Lal's blows weren't even leaving marks on the creature's hide. "Don't touch metal," I said, pulling the pry bar from its loop on my tool belt. The worm extended into the cabin like a stream of pus. Its foreparts twisted to the right, probably following Monica, whom I couldn't see. The creature had crawled up the 8-inch pipe and into the hold where I'd taken the section out. For safety, I had thought. "Don't touch metal," I repeated, and laid the bar between the live contact of the knife switch and the bulkhead, shorting the load into the steel fabric of the ship. Metal exploded. Blue coruscants momentarily sprang from every surface. The bar jerked in my gloved hand. It would have thrown me onto my back except for my death grip. The current had welded both ends in the microsecond before the circuit breaker flipped. "Are you all right?" I called. I stepped back from the switch and took off my right glove. The bar was glowing red and had started to burn me. "Monica, are you all right?"
"Yes," she called. "Is it dead?"
Her voice wavered, but mine too sounded tinny in my own ears. The short circuit had been as loud as lightning striking a power pole 20 feet away. "It's dead," I said, leaning over the worm's smoking corpse so that I could look around the bulkhead. Monica sat on her mattress, her legs drawn up to her chest and her arms hugging them tightly. Her eyes held mine.
The worm's head had reached the edge of the bunk when I electrocuted it. Now the body was shriveling. A pool of liquid continued to spread beneath the charred skin. "You can touch metal again," I said. I suddenly realized that until I'd removed the pry bar, there was a dead short if I closed the circuit breaker. I stepped back and kicked the middle of the bar with my boot heel, cracking both welds. The bar fell to the deck. Monica got off the bunk.
"Can we get this thing off the ship?"
she said, looking down at the worm. She moved sideways as the leaking fluids approached her soft boots.
"I sure hope so," I said. "Law, grab this with me and let's see if we can get it through the main hatch while the skin's still holding together." It smelled awful. A few years ago, a fish 30 feet long, I'd never learned what it had been when it was alive, had washed up on the shore of the island where we had a vacation home. It had been dead at least a month, and most of the skin had sloughed off. I hadn't imagined that I would ever smell anything that bad again.
"Let me put a suit on and I'll help push,"
Monica said, trotting over to the suit locker.
"I would have gotten the gun from there if there had been time, but after the thing pushed the door open, it was between me and the locker."
I didn't blame her for wanting to wear protective gear before she touched the worm. This was one of those awful jobs that you did and did your best to forget about afterward. With Lal holding two hands full of the skin on one side and me doing the same on the other, we were able to get the front of the body over the hatch combing. It was easy then to slide it across the deck and onto the boarding ramp. By then, Monica was ready to help us dump it into the lagoon. We rolled the worm off the edge of the ramp. At least half of its original mass was a tacky smear on the deck.
"I'll start washing the ship out," Monica said. "I don't suppose there's anything like a mop aboard."
"Look," said Lal, pointing into the lagoon. Platt's body floated near the ramp. It was wrigglingly fuzzy, much as the grating had been. The birds, the big insects, I guess, were diving down and spearing some of the worms which were burrowing into the floating corpse. They collided with one another in the air, making a louder version of the clattering we'd heard before.
"My God," Monica said softly. It sounded like a real prayer.
"I'll see about getting the ship ready to lift," I said. "I don't know how much damage the short circuit did."
"The gun wouldn't have stopped it, would it?" Monica said.
"I'll see how much damage I did," I repeated. "Then I'll help you and Law clean." I spent nearly an hour with the circuitry. The console was unharmed. It was completely shielded from the hull. Most of the time I took involved me poking about in the switch box, where a small circuit board had fed the console's commands to the pump. It had disintegrated. I literally wasn't sure what the components had been, let alone being able to replace or bypass them. Staring at the ruin didn't make it less complete. I finally gave up and joined my shipmates. They'd made scrubbing pads from rope and garments, a breech clout and a gauzy underlayer of Monica's shift. Food boxes served as buckets.
"If I'd known we were going to do this," Monica said brightly as I approached, "I'd have saved Platt's clothing before I put him over the side."
"I'm not going to fight the worms for it," I said, squatting down. The job was almost done, at least as much as it could be with what we had. It would take lye and a good airing to really clean the Alfrost. I think the mother must breed in this lagoon to protect the eggs and hatchlings from predators in the open sea. All but the flying ones, of course. I nodded, but I wasn't really paying attention. I'd smiled to my shipmates' hopeful faces, but I let my expression settle back into the resignation which I felt. "Look," I said, "we're not going to be able to head straight for Saguntum as I'd hoped. The pump switch can't be repaired, and we don't have enough reaction mass to make the whole voyage. We have to replace the switch."
"What does that mean?"
Monica asked with an appearance of calm. Lal simply watched me, much the way a rabbit might watch a snake. "Plaquemines is within the amount of reaction mass we've got aboard," I said, hoping that I sounded more confident than I felt. "It's a developed world, enough that I'd even heard of it on Cinnabar. We'll be able to replace the switch circuitry there." I cleared my throat. "The thing is, the parts and probably labor aren't going to be really expensive, but they'll cost more than I've got in coins. I'll need to get a job and raise some money. I don't think that'll be hard, but don't know how long it'll take. 2-3 weeks, I guess."
"You say, not really expensive," Monica said. "How expensive is that?"
I was a little disturbed by the intensity with which she looked at me. I shrugged and said, "On Xenos, I'd guess about 300 florins. I don't know prices on plaque mines, of course." Not for the first time,
I regretted that the Alfraz didn't have a set of sailing directions for the region. I'm not sure there was one, but the fleet had probably compiled a similar set.
That would be about 500 Alliance Thalers, wouldn't it? Monica said.
About, I agreed, more than a little surprised that she was familiar with the conversion rate. Cinnabar currency had been unknown on Ben Yusuf, and it must be rare even on Saguntum. I've got 22 at the moment.
Monica lifted her hands to her hair and brought down the jewel barrette she'd taken, back from Azul, the night we escaped. It opened when she squeezed a hidden catch. A credit chip popped out. She handed it to me and said, "Here, this is good for $10,000 at the Central Bank of Plaisance." I took it, then raised my eyes to meet hers. "Who is she?"
"In that case," I said aloud, "the only trick is getting to plaque mines. That's my job." I rose from my squat. "I'll start plotting the course right now." I walked to the console. "Who the hell is she?"
Chapter 27 Karst Registry Freighter Alfraz requests landing permission for St. Marie's Port, I said on the 20-meter band. "Alfraz requests to land, over." The Alfraz had a microwave suite, but I was a little surprised to hear it chirp. "Plaque Mines Control to Alfraz. What is your cargo, Alfraz? Over." I'd noticed a second ship in orbit, a little below us as we approached, but I hadn't expected it to be a customs vessel. Saguntum had one, but the briefing materials I'd read before the voyage had suggested such formalities were rare in the region. Plaque Mines might be a more significant place than I'd expected. "Plaque Mines, this is Captain Ofetri of the Alfraz," I said. "We're landing for minor repairs. We have no cargo. Over." I hoped that the microwave antenna was self-aiming. That is, that it responded on the reciprocal of the signal it had received. I hadn't been sure that the microwave worked at all, and I certainly didn't fancy my chances of manually aiming a tight beam antenna. "Proceed to St. Marie Port, Alfraz," the voice responded. "Do not leave your ship before you've been inspected by port officials. Plaque Mines Control out." "Thank you, Plaque Mines Control," I said. "Alfraz out." He looked at my shipmates and said, "They've marked a berth for us. Just so you know, I'm going to let the console bring us in down to the last 10 feet. I'll take over there and complete the landing." I grinned, but I was pretty nervous about it in truth. "If that turns out to be a bad idea," I said, "I'll let the machine do the whole job the next time. Now that we know to brace ourselves good for the last bit." I was tired and I hurt all over. Lal and I had been doing the work of six, though the ordinary crew of a tramp in this region would have been three or four rather than six. An air suit didn't rub as badly as a hard suit did, but it was a protective garment and as rugged to the wearer's skin as it was to the conditions outside. The high drive engaged. When the thrusters took over, the atmosphere began to bounce us around. I don't suppose I'd ever trust the rig of the Alfraz, but the clamps had been working as well as anyone could ask. We came low enough to land on our second circuit within the atmosphere. The Alfraz was underpowered, certainly compared to a warship, but her weak acceleration and braking meant that sloppy control linkages didn't get her into trouble quickly. I guess I was coming to like the old girl. She was, after all, my first command. The console guided us toward the berth the port authorities had chosen. St. Marie Port was on a mile-wide river, 50 miles up from the coast. The surrounding continent had been a surface of yellow-green vegetation, with occasional rectangles of different colors, plantations cut by human settlers. A red telltale alerted me that the ship's sensors thought we were 20 feet above the surface. I took manual control and locked the thruster output at the current level. We continued to descend on the programmed course, entering the key from the open mouth. As we slid toward the far end, I adjusted the thruster angle 5 degrees forward, and with my other hand flared the sphincter pedals gradually. The usual gush of steam warned me we were about to touch down. The outriggers hit with solid splashes, the port one an instant before the starboard. I chopped the throttles and leaned back. It hadn't been perfect, but it was pretty bloody good. The hours I'd been spending on the simulator had been worth it.
"What do we do now?" Monica said.
"Now we wait for the local inspectors to clear us," I said without getting up. I was worse wrung out by the landing than I'd been by the days of doing two men's work in the rigging. Same as always. I thought for a moment and added, "Except I think I'll open the ship up a little quicker than I'd do if that worm hadn't melted the way it did."
Ozone and garbage burned by the thrusters didn't seem too bad as an alternative to the present onboard atmosphere.
"Good heavens," the inspector said as he stepped into the main hatch. He backed away, then turned and stared at me.
"Good heavens," he said.
"A wild animal got aboard while we were taking on water," I said. We'd met the official at the foot of the boarding ramp. I'd walked him up while Monica and Lal waited below. "We had to kill it, but the reaction mass pump was damaged. We need to repair that, but we're also going to pick up cleaning supplies."
"I should think so," the inspector said.
He craned his neck and looked around the nearly empty hold.
"You're welcome to search us," I said. "We recaptured the ship from pirates, and it had been completely stripped. We just want to get home to Saguntum."
That was as much fancy as truth, but the official didn't need details which would just confuse him. He could see we didn't have any dutiable goods aboard.
"I don't see any reason to waste more time here," the inspector said.
He jotted on his metal back pad, then tore off and handed me one end of the form. He kept the counterfoil.
"Carry the inspection report to the port office," he said as we walked back to my shipmates. "You'll still have to pay landing fees, but that will be hull only. $40.
"I suppose the Chandleries are on Water Street?" I said.
"St. Marie Street, we call it," the man said. "But yes, I recommend the Trident House myself."
"We'll try it," I agreed. The inspector got into the saddle of his jitney and rode off. I said to Monica, "We'll try the Trident House, his recommendation." She frowned.
"He's probably been paid to say that," she said.
"Of course," I said. "He wasn't a prick the way petty officials always can be. Even if his brother owns the place, that's still a good reason to do business there if they're halfway reasonable."
Lal didn't say anything. I'm not sure he'd even heard the exchange. He figured it was none of his business, I suppose. That was how I figured, too, if it came to that.
Trident House was the furthest of the three ship chandlers facing the harbor, and was a little more imposing than the others. The doorway was framed by bright yellow pillars running up to roof height. The counter and back was painted a matching color. I walked up the central aisle and said to the middle-aged man behind the counter, "I need an electrician and a switch circuit for the reaction mass pump."
"And we need bleach and mops," said Monica.
She remained slightly behind me, but she was fully part of the discussion.
"Of course," said the counterman. "We normally use Ricardo. I'll give you directions to his shop."
He coughed into his hand and said,
"Do you have an account here, Captain?"
"We're good for the cost," I said, smiling. I handed over the credit chip. I hadn't given it back to Monica. I'd seen that at any distance from Cinnabar and the core worlds of the Alliance, women tended to be taken less seriously than men. To tell the truth, even in Xenos, especially as he went down the social scale, there were plenty of situations in which I figured I'd get a better deal than Monica would have. The counterman inserted the card into his reader, then looked up at me with sudden respect.
"I see, sir."
"Before you find the electrician," Monica said, "I want mops and 5 gallons of bleach. Lal and I can get started on the cleanup." She pursed her lips and added,
"And clothing. Ordinary spacer's clothes, but clean. Several changes."
"And for me also," I added.
"Lal?"
"If the captain is willing, a set of slops would be welcome," he said.
"And 200 thalers cash," I said to the counterman, "if you're willing to be our bank."
"Of course, captain," he said. He opened a cash drawer.
I wondered what he made of us. We were an odd-looking trio, certainly. Remembering what I'd told the customs inspector, I said, "We escaped from pirates, but we don't have much besides money in the ship."
"That's quite sufficient for me," said the counterman with a grin.
Monica, Lal, and a boy with a trident handcart returned to the Alfraz. Monica had $150, of her own money, of course. I found Ricardo's shop easily, halfway down the nearest cross street. But the woman there explained he was out on a job. She sent me with their 10-year-old son as a guide to find him. We did, but the job was on the opposite side of St. Marie. Ricardo made a good impression and agreed to come out to the Alfraz in the morning to spec the job. But he wouldn't leave this afternoon, even if I doubled the extra $10 I'd offered him to slip our job in before he finished wiring the new construction he was working on. It was nearing evening by the time the boy led me back to the port office and left me. The clerks had already gone home, so I wearily trudged to the quay and down it, looking for the Alfraz. What was left of the preserved food we'd brought from Ben Yusuf wasn't very exciting, but I was looking forward to a quiet meal and then sleep. Sleep out on the outrigger. I'd gotten used to the stench of the ship's interior, but sleeping in an atmosphere of chlorine bleach would be dangerous instead of merely uncomfortable.
The lights of the Alphrage shone in the dusk. Every hatch was open. Monica and Lal were at the bottom on the boarding ramp. She sat cross-legged. He squatted. They rose as they heard me approach. "I thought we'd make up shakedowns on the outriggers tonight," I said. I didn't see the piles of bedding, but I hoped had been removed before they doused the ship's interior with bleach.
"I've taken care of that," Monica said calmly. "Roy, what's the correct pay for a spacer?"
"On Cinnabar?" I said. "A floor and a day for a landsman. 1.5 for an ordinary spacer, 2 for an able spacer." Monica sat again and began counting coins onto the ramp where the ship's running lights fell on them. She said,
"Lal, we're paying you as an able spacer. Is that acceptable to you?"
"Lady, that is very generous," Lal said. He bowed to her before he scooped the coins into a purse which hung under his breech clout. Lal probably wasn't qualified as able, but he still wasn't being overpaid. He'd worked like 2 men on this voyage.
"I suggest you find a meal and accommodations on your own," Monica said. "You're dismissed until noon tomorrow."
He bowed again. "Thank you, lady," he said, and disappeared up the quay. Ordinarily, pay and duty schedules were the business of the captain alone. I suspected that Monica already knew that. I didn't feel any desire to raise the matter aloud.
"I rented a houseboat," Monica said to me. "I thought we could spend the night there. It didn't look like rain, but I wouldn't feel comfortable simply laying out in the open on a strange planet."
She looked away and added,
"Also, I bought fresh food which we can heat now that you've arrived. On the boat, that is."
"Great idea," I said honestly. I was confused by all this. Everything Monica had arranged was good, but it was different from the very simple 1 foot in front of the other evening I'd planned. I was physically and mentally tired, and I resented even good changes that made me think. I hadn't noted the houseboat floating between the starboard outrigger and the hull of the Alphraz. It was about 20 feet long, with most of the length covered by a curved roof. We stepped easily from the boarding ramp to the short deck in the bow. I sat on a cushion while Monica heated the meal she'd bought, a stew of meat and vegetables. The stove was a can half filled with sand into which she'd poured diesel, which wicked up to burn safely at the surface.
"I didn't really make it myself," she said. "I bought it from a restaurant on shore and brought it back to heat when you got here. The food we've been eating is so bland and I wanted something different."
"This is much better," I agreed, though it was really a little too spicy for me. She must have bought the bowls and spoons, too.
If I can ask you a personal question?"
"You can," Monica said, looking up. "You haven't asked me anything all the time we've been together." There were a couple of reasons for that, and I didn't plan to go into them now. I said, "You have money. Why weren't you ransomed instead of being stuck in the Admiral's harem?"
"Well, I couldn't buy myself free," she said. "They'd have just stolen the credit chip if they'd known about it, the way Azul did the Barrette. And the Karst consul couldn't allow me to be freed after he'd helped rape me instead of doing his duty to me as a Saguntine citizen."
She swallowed and put her spoon down beside her bowl. Staring at them, she said,
"Maybe if I'd screamed at the beginning that I was important, it would have been better. But I was from Saguntum, and I thought I'd be all right if I just kept in the background and it'd all be over."
"That was what I'd have done too," I said, though I really didn't have any idea what I'd have done in her situation. Because of our different genders, there was no real comparison in the ways the pirates had treated us. Monica started to cry. I don't know what I'd been expecting, but it wasn't that. It had gotten really dark while we ate. I'd thought of bringing out the little light I'd bought in Salaam, but I hadn't gotten around to it. Pretty clearly, this wasn't the time to climb up to the hold of the Alphraz and go rummaging around. Though I've got to admit, the thought crossed my mind. I put my hand on Monica's shoulder. I didn't say anything. I set my bowl to the side, but she knocked hers aside as she threw her arms around my neck and drew herself against me. I patted her on the back, wondering what the hell to do. Suddenly, Monica straightened. I wished there'd been some light so that I could see her face.
"What's the matter?" she said. "Don't you like me? Why don't you kiss me?"
I kissed her, but withdrew a little and said, "I like you very much, but I didn't want to. I didn't want to have her scream, 'You raped me,' at me sometime in the future. I don't want to take advantage of you," I said. I didn't know where her head was right this instant, and she obviously wasn't in the best shape.
"Is it because I was raped?" she said.
Her voice rose,
Do you think I'm dirty?
No, I said. Monica, you're wonderful. She kissed me hard.
Then come, she said. I want to make love. And I want to make love with you. And so we did.
Chapter 28.